The stories of the veterans of World War II. This fall, KSL accompanied dozens of these men and women to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. KSL News Radio's Mark Juke presents Honor Flight, A Generation's Journey.
They came from the farms and the cities.
There wasn't anybody that didn't go. Every one of us went.
Some had brothers already in uniform.
This is the second brother who was in the Naval Academy.
All were young.
The average age of a gunner on our bombers was 18 and a half years old. The average of pilots was only 19 and a half.
Millions of people enlisted or were drafted during the war, while others remained on the home front. Some fought in fierce battles.
So much of it was so unnecessary, a lot of it. That's war for you.
Some served in support roles.
They were bright, they were dependable, they were needed.
All have stories to tell. And now, some seven decades later, a few are being given the chance to fly to Washington, D.C. to visit the World War II Memorial. Though they didn't really know each other during war, it's still a reunion of sorts. They share a common experience from a troubled time. On the morning of September 18th, 66 veterans and their guardians gathered at the hangar at the Utah Air National Guard Base to begin their honor flight. Frank Burns, the oldest veteran on the flight, 98, was given a flag to carry with him in memory of those who served and those who did not come back and of those who died before they were able to see the memorial.
It's a great honor for me. We think about them every day, but you just have to think them by heart.
Burns was the first married man with children from Davis County to be drafted during the war. He left a wife and two children home.
Well, it was terrible. I hated every minute of it, but it was something we had to do. It was harder on them than it was on me.
Something they had to do, but something many willingly did, a fact that still surprises people like E. Howard Clements.
The Naval Squadron drives through the waters of the Skagerrak for the surprise attack that transformed the war in Europe.
Who stormed the beaches at Normandy on D-Day.
Everybody was worried about whether the Germans were going to come over here and take us over, or whether the Japanese were, and so everybody answered the call willingly. And I'll never forget going over that ladder in Normandy, and you got to forgive me because I cry. But if you have to talk about it, you have to remember it, see? And that's why. But I can remember going down that rope net into the landing craft. And there was nobody hesitated, not for a minute. It wasn't, nobody said, "Oh, Mama, you know, I don't want to go." Half of us were going to be killed. They told us that. And so, but everybody went anyway. They didn't hesitate a minute. And neither did I.
Clements, who has not taken an honor flight, shares a common experience with some who did.
When they saw the German concentration camps, men toughened by combat were sickened.
Late in the war, he helped liberate concentration camps.
There was a man that was right at the gate, and he was lying there with his back and looked up at me. I knew he knew I was there because he looked up at me, and his little boy was holding his hand. And he looked like he was about five, and I said, "Now you hang on. Now hang on, they're going to have water and food for you." And I gave him a little taste of water. But they warned us just after we got there, really, we had no idea that we were going to run into that. He was looking up in the air. I gave him some water and a blanket. I gave him my GI blanket. I told him again in English, he didn't speak English, but I said, "Armies, you're coming and you're going to have food, you know, so you stay right here, don't try to leave." But they realized that we were, you know, the American Army, so they didn't. They stayed right there, and you know, I turned around and came back to this guy that was laying on the ground, and he was dead. And the little boy was stands still holding his hand, and I went to see what was happening outside the gate and came back, and he was dead.
Clemens says of all the fighting he witnessed and took part in, that experience is the one that stays with him the most. Military and civilian groups like the Patriot Guard do their part in support of Honor Flight. The Patriot Guard often escorts buses to and from the airport. Inside the terminal, a new surprise that literally had some of the vets dancing in the hallway. Later, bagpipes led the group to their gate, accompanied by spontaneous applause from other travelers. On this trip were former soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen, as well as two women, a wasp and a wave, two of the vets, husband and wife, a brother and sister brought both grandfathers. Dallas Popa served on the USS South Dakota. It was a hurricane that nearly did him and his crew in more than combat. Willis Burton served in Europe.
I enlisted in the Air Corps. I was in the Air Corps until the Battle of the Bulls. Then they got transferred us into the infantry.
For Lane Popa, having both grandfathers along was a treat.
It's overwhelming. To be here with both of them is amazing.
Also among the guardians, a teacher who volunteered to accompany a vet in part so he could share his experiences with his students.
We all have heroes.
Wayne Madsen is a 7th grade teacher at West Point Junior High School.
As you look up there, I know I talked to you about a couple of those guys. The one on the left, he never came home from World War II.
Madsen was partnered with Art Meredith, who was a Navy medic during the war.
I'm amazed by him. You know, a lot of them won't really say anything about what they did or where they went or what happened until just the last few years. But in finding out about that, I found they did wonderful things that I'm amazed.
Guardians are often children or grandchildren of the veterans. In training, they're told the trip is not about them, but about those they're accompanying. And they're told it is hard work. Claire Carden was a guardian for her father, Daniel Friedman.
They did what they had to do. They followed orders, and our world is a better place because of them.
Jenna Lee Frazier took her father and a friend of his on an earlier flight.
Pretty emotional. He had not seen that, and it was just a great experience for him. They both have just lit up. It's like they've become young men again.
Her father served in the Pacific for 3 years. Frazier says there were many highlights for him on the trip.
I think probably watching the changing of the guard at Arlington was very, very moving for him. And he loved the World War II Memorial. But he also enjoyed the Korean Memorial. There was just something about that when you walk in there and see those statues standing in the forest area that it made it feel alive.
Alrighty, folks, once again, good morning. Welcome aboard. We're on our way to Baltimore.
It's about a 4-hour flight from Utah to Washington, D.C., giving veterans a chance to get acquainted, share stories, or just rest. One tradition on Utah flights, a bit of song. Mid-flight, another surprise. The letters come from family, friends, and complete strangers. For this flight, there were hundreds of them. Some came from employees at local businesses sponsoring the trip, others from students at Judge Memorial High School.
Dear hero, I'm very honored to have been given
Caroline
the opportunity
Holyoke was among them.
And for most of us, our biggest concern is our AP Calc homework. And we don't think about what it would be like to go over in another country and every day wonder if you were going to live.
During the war, letters from home didn't always come, nor did letters to home. Jim Jarvis flew a B-25 in the Pacific. Another brother was an officer on a submarine, and a third was in the infantry in Europe. All the time, their mother awaited news at their home in Arkansas.
I'm sure it bothered her sometimes when the mail didn't get there. But she survived like the rest of us did.
Jarvis says he's happy all three of his brothers returned when so many died.
I had a brother who enlisted in the Marine Corps.
Manly Abbott, a gunner on a bomber, was one who did return, as did his brother. But two younger brothers who served in Korea did not. Wendy Pierce is Abbott's daughter.
I kind of get that my grandmother probably expected those sons to come home because her first two did. And I think it was really devastating when the first one died. And then to have the second one pass away too, it was very difficult.
Coming up, a visit to the memorial and remembering the prisoners of war and those still missing as Honor Flight, A Generation's Journey, continues.
KSL News Radio and reporter Mark Juke presents Honor Flight, A Generation's Journey.
Just near the south entrance of the World War II Memorial, they line up in two rows, 33 veterans on each side and their guardians, as the flags that drape the caskets of some who wanted to make the flight but did not are presented. One is for Courtney Kruger, who died this summer at age 91. More than seven decades later, Kruger's daughter, Connie Wright, thinks his war experience ultimately contributed to his death.
It explained why he was who he was to me, because I didn't really understand that aspect of his life and how much that really changed him.
During 3 years in captivity, Kruger suffered brutal conditions.
He lived off of rice, basically. He told me that they'd gather some weeds and boil it in water to make some soup. And their meat consisted of catching rats that were living there with him, as well as cockroaches.
Kruger was also a survivor of the so-called Hell Ships, former passenger ships used by the Japanese to move prisoners from island to island.
And those ships, because they were so old and decrepit, would break down. And then they'd be stranded out there in the ocean for days on end.
The prisoners were often jammed in the ship's hold for weeks.
If somebody died, what they'd have to do is they'd just pass them overhead to get them off the ship.
Near the entrance of the memorial, Terry Clausen clutches a flag, a rose, and a black and white framed photo of his father.
He served in the Merchant Marines during the war, and he didn't talk a lot about the war. It wasn't until later on, when it was his 50th wedding anniversary and I was in Pearl Harbor, we shared a little bit about the war and what he served in the war. It was very sacred to him and the things that went there. In fact, I visited this memorial the first time the day before he passed away. I came to Washington, D.C. knowing that he would not be around, so to share this with him again is a great experience.
By some estimates, as many as 250,000 men served in the Merchant Marine during the war. They moved troops, supplies, and armor, making them prime targets for German U-boats. Though they suffered enormous losses during the war, the Merchant Marine were not granted veteran status until the late 1970s. Some of Clausen's father's personal experiences went with him to the grave.
You know, I don't know, because he never shared much about the war. Other than as a young man, he has great fears about, you know, on those ships when they were carrying, you know, servicemen out across the ocean in the Pacific and over in Europe. I don't know. Other than war and what it brings, the war is a great trauma. I mean, I don't understand that. I'd never had to serve.
Near the fountains at the World War II Memorial, a soldier played taps as part of a ceremony in honor of the Utah vets. To the south, a memorial to those in the Atlantic conflict. To the north, one for those in the Pacific. West of the fountain, a wall of gold stars. There are just over 4,000 of them. The sight gave Mel Owen pause when he visited as part of a June honor flight.
It's unfathomable the amount of people that lost. We lost 120 Air Force, 120,000 Air Force men. 120,000. Can you imagine how many that is? I see all these stars, each one representing 100 personnel, and I think we can't imagine what that loss was.
Owen was a navigator on a B-17 over Europe.
An enemy plane shot the B-17 right to the left of us. It went down with the 10 men in it. What was left of it somersaulted right over in front of me, and here I am right in the front of the B-17, and we're just about to hit it, and it exploded in a million pieces, or I wouldn't be here.
Owen was also an artist responsible for the nose art on numerous bombers. George Ford was also on a bomber over Europe.
It was a kind of a hard experience. We lost a navigator over Nuremberg, and we were shot up real bad over Berlin, and things like that, and so those were part of the war.
But near the end of the war, a different kind of mission.
8th Air Force heavies dropped food in Nazi-occupied Holland at Utrecht, Rotterdam, and Amsterdam.
Allied planes were allowed by Germany to drop food to the starving people of Holland in Operations Manna and Chowhound.
Very, very much a a joy and a pleasure to be able to help those people in need and dropping food there, because we went in at about a couple of hundred feet and dropped it in designated places. The people was all over the hanging out windows on roofs, and they wrote in tulips down as we flew over, thank you. And it just made you feel so good to be able to do that after the destruction that had been going on to help those people in need.
40 years later, Ford was one of 21 Americans invited back to Holland to commemorate the anniversary of the food drops.
It was there that I was chosen to receive the Medal of Liberation for the United States. And I thought that was a really great honor in that regard.
Another bomber crew member, Manley Abbott, flew with the honor flight in June. His visit to the memorial caused him to ponder his experience as a belly turret gunner and words like courage.
What is it? You know, you're up there at the 25, 30,000 feet, somebody 5 miles away shooting at you. You're not going to get out and walk. You just got to stay with it and carry it through.
Others served on the ground in Europe, like Quentin Murdoch, an infantry officer.
Well, I was in the famous first Infantry Division, and I started in North Africa against Rommel down there. And after we chased him out of Africa, he was the first one to land in Sicily, and we fought all the way through Sicily. And then they had to have us back to England to do the invasion of Normandy, and so we were the first ones to hit Omaha Beach on D-Day in Normandy.
An assignment took him away from his regular platoon that day.
But when we went into Normandy, they had me take the vehicles, and all of my platoon that I had before, all but two of them was killed on D-Day.
There was another famed fighting group in Europe, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, made up entirely of Japanese-American soldiers like Casey Kunimura, who now lives in North Ogden. While he fought, some of Kunimura's family were in an internment camp in Arizona. He says that gave him and others like him in the 442nd all the more reason to fight.
We're going to lay it all on the line, and that's the model they picked up, go for broke.
In 2011, members of the team received the Congressional Gold Medal for their service. Kunimura and a handful of other Utahns were there. Coming up, the view from those who fought in the Pacific, from Pearl Harbor to Iwo Jima to Okinawa and Tokyo, as Honor Flight A Generation's Journey continues.
The stories of the veterans of World War II. This fall, KSL accompanied dozens of these men and women to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. KSL News Radio's Mark Juke presents Honor Flight, A Generation's Journey.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It was the attack that propelled the United States into World War II.
First to feel the sting of Japanese steel are the USS Oklahoma and Utah.
And Emmett Cyclone Davis was there. Davis, who now lives in Highland, was a P-40 pilot based in Hawaii. The military had been on alert for days, but for some reason was not on Sunday, December 7th. Davis was sleeping in that morning when the attack began.
And I looked out the window and I saw a Japanese dive bomber, they're going down on the line. So I jumped out of bed and put my coveralls on and my flight suit.
He jumped into a friend's convertible and they sped toward the airfield.
And we got strafed by the Japanese as we drove down there.
At the airfield, they first taxied the unburned planes away from fires. Then they armed a P-40 and Davis got airborne. He flew three missions that day, one that nearly cost him his life.
We turned and flew across Pearl Harbor. Every gun they had down there started shooting at us. And so we got out of that mess and didn't lose anybody. But we went back and landed and told them they'd have to get the Navy under control if they want any escort.
Davis saw the destruction from the air.
They dropped all our bombs and sank three or four ships and a lot of smoke there. And we knew it was in a war.
Many of those on September 18th's honor flight had served in the Pacific and fought or supported forces on a costly 3-year-long campaign toward Tokyo. Their visit to the memorial was an emotional one.
Ready, sobering. Brought back lots of memories. I've always wanted to come here ever since it was built.
About a quarter of the stars at the World War II Memorial represent more than 100,000 lives lost in the Pacific Theater.
Here's a picture book.
On December 6, 1941, Earl Sorensen, Wallace Gatrell, and the rest of the 145th Field Artillery Battalion were on the Tasker H. Bliss headed to the Philippines. On December 7th, the ship turned around and was eventually sent to Hawaii.
We were the first Army troops from the mainland into Hawaii after December 7th.
Yeah.
And we were really, really welcomed, I'll tell you that.
But the 145th didn't stay long.
We was on half the islands in the Pacific,
including Kwajalein, Guam, and Saipan, the Philippines, and finally Okinawa, the last land fight in the war.
That lasted 3 months. Day and night.
One of Sorensen's clearest memories was not fighting, though, but of a civilian, a woman discovered in what he described as a hole in the ground.
And she had a 2-year-old boy with her.
At first, Sorensen says she was terrified. She calmed down when the soldiers took her to a civilian camp where she was given food and water.
I don't know how long she'd been in that hole, but she'd been in there a long time.
8 square miles of volcanic ash. Now the target of a United States Marine attack.
Before Okinawa, it was Iwo Jima, initially seen by the U.S. as a strategic launching point. For the Japanese, though, the small island was their home soil. 6,800 Americans died on Iwo Jima. There were some 26,000 casualties. Art Hopkinson was on the USS Arkansas, a battleship used to bombard the island.
So we were trying to destroy every pillbox that the Japanese had. And that's how come we got so close. Close enough almost that we would be grounded if we'd have gotten any closer.
Cornelius DeYoung was there too on a transport boat assigned to the USS Barrow.
They lowered those LCVPs down into the water. The Marines crawled over the side on nets, got into them, and our job was to take them over and land them on the beach.
In spite of the bombardment, resistance was fierce.
We had to go up and down the beach to find a place to land, because they were shooting these mortar shells right down from off the top of the runway there, right into the boats and blowing them up.
DeYoung saw many of the casualties firsthand.
Every night we would go out to sea and bury the dead.
Both Hopkinson and DeYoung watched from sea on day 5 of the battle as 5 Marines and a Navy corpsman raised the American flag on Mount Suribachi.
The Marines were coming up. We could see that something was going on there, and so there they were, starting to push that flag up in the air. And it was a magnificent sight. Everybody, when we started hollering what was going on, everybody stopped to look to see. I will say, you get an 18-year-old kid, just about a 19-year-old, to see something that excites him enough that he'll cry.
The battle for the island continued for another month, resulting in more than 22,000 Japanese casualties. After Iwo Jima, the Navy guns moved on.
We went from there, from Iwo Jima to Okinawa, and bombarded Okinawa. Then we come back to this Bay of Japan, and we were already throwing big shells into the city, or into the shoreline, I should say. And then they drew us back, and the captain said, we're going to go over closer away from Japan.
That move surprised everyone.
We thought we were going to go in and just destroy everything. But and we would have killed so many more because they didn't want to surrender. And so when they drew us back, the Captain Deweese got on the radio and said, we're going to have a movie. A movie? Yes. And so, but before we have this movie, I want to tell you something. Tomorrow, we're going to surprise Japan with a very small bomb. And it's going to end the war.
Hopkinson couldn't believe it.
And we just roared. We laughed. We thought, oh, how ridiculous. We were already dropping $1,000 or 1,000-pound bombs then. And so it was a shock, and it was a shock when it was over.
As Hopkinson's ship sat at sea, another Utah man was on his way to the island of Tinian, where the Enola Gay was based. H. Blaine Hall had just completed training as a radio operator on a B-29. In San Francisco, he and his crew learned of the bombing of Hiroshima.
One of the guys got up and come back with a newspaper announcing the dropping of the bomb into the big picture. And I thought, wow, what a thing.
But the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki did not immediately stop preparations to invade Japan. Hall and his crew were soon on their way in their B-29. They learned over the radio days later that Japan had surrendered. This past summer, Hall's family arranged a flight on Fifi, a restored B-29. They brought along with them that day a photo of the Enola Gay sitting on the tarmac on Tinian.
The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That's
on August 29, 1945, the Navy's Third Fleet sailed into Tokyo Bay. The USS Roy, with Kurt Christensen on board, was part of the massive group.
And I can see ships everywhere. As far as you could see, ships.
3 days later, Admiral William Halsey was on the USS Missouri to accept Japan's surrender.
Then he said, "This is the largest collection this world has ever known. See all this sea power in one group. This will never, ever happen again." He repeated three different times, "Look, see, and remember."
Christensen had another experience at sea, one that finally he got a chance to tell KSL's Doug Wright about 7 decades later.
I was on duty as a radar operator on board ship at that particular day, and I had it all figured out that back home in Salt Lake City was the time for the Tabernacle Choir broadcast.
He wasn't sure he could get it.
I picked one that had the AM band on it, and I just fooled around, see if I could find anything. Then the Tabernacle Choir came on.
Again we pause at the crossroads of the West. As Columbia presents...
That was home. I loved it.
Leaving the World War II Memorial, the Veterans of Honor flight spent time on the Mall, visiting the Korean and Vietnam, as well as the Lincoln Memorials. As in many other honor flights, there were veterans in the group who served in World War II and Korea. Coming up, a visit to Arlington, remembering FDR, and an emotional return as Honor Flight, A Generation's Journey continues.
KSL News Radio and reporter Mark Juke presents Honor Flight, A Generation's Journey.
Up! Out there! Up!
On the third Friday of every September, the military in Washington, D.C. pauses to honor those who were taken prisoner and those who are still listed as missing in action from foreign conflicts. It is National POW MIA Recognition Day, and members of the Utah Honor Flight were on hand for the ceremony. At the base of the Air Force Memorial, with its three spires arching skyward, settings were placed at an empty table.
The POW MIA table is a physical symbol of the thousands of American prisoners of war and missing in action still unaccounted for from all foreign conflicts.
Frank Jones knows firsthand what it's like to be a prisoner of war. Jones was captured after his bomber was shot down in 1942.
Only four of us made it out of the plane when it exploded.
He spent nearly 5 months in captivity.
We'd been eating soup quite often. What they gave us, we call it green death. It looked like it made out of lucerne, alfalfa, and it had yellow bonds of beans in there. And we'd been eating it for a couple of weeks, and I said to my buddy, "What's that little black spot on those beans?" He said, "Jones, don't you know?" I said, "No." He said, "Squeeze one." So I picked one out and squeezed it. Weevil popped out. So I picked them all out and set it aside. Didn't have any soup left. Put them back in there.
His camp was liberated on April 29, 1943. An estimated 130,000 Americans were held prisoner during World War II, with a 1% death rate for prisoners in German camps and a 40% death rate for those in Japanese captivity. More than 70,000 are still officially listed as unaccounted from World War II. From the Air Force Memorial to Arlington.
Up! Out there! Up!
Those who could stand did so at the changing of the guard over the Tomb of the Unknown. Others watched from their wheelchairs. Arlington is home to more than 400,000 military graves.
These were men who died on the fringe of the atomic age.
Decades before his visit to Arlington, Bryce Hallows had stood at another cemetery, this one on the island of Okinawa. He was part of an honorary guard, a rifleman firing volleys for fallen Marines of the 6th Division. He says the fighting was fierce.
It just seemed like when I was a young boy thrown out there in that and got into it, I thought, oh, this is terrible. What are people doing to each other? You know, how sick can we be? Put these demands on the young guys like this, you know, never go back home to see our mothers and our families. That's terrible. And it got worse every day from that point.
During one battle, a bullet shattered the stock of his M1 rifle. He hastily reassembled and repaired it with parts from the rifles of others who had fallen. He used that same rifle to fire volleys of salute to his fallen Marines at a ceremony on July 4th, 1945. The 6th Marine Division Cemetery is no longer there.
Later on, our government and Congress decided that if the families wanted to... If the families wanted them to come home, why they would ship them home.
Other remains lie now at the Cemetery of the Pacific in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Hey, guys.
Saturday morning, day 3 of Utah's honor flight, took them first to the memorial for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the man who was president when the war began. Roosevelt died in 1945. Hubert Robison played a unique role in the funeral. He was part of a B-17 crew involved in a formation flyover of the procession. The vets also paid a visit to Fort McHenry in Baltimore before they boarded their flight home, where they unfolded a replica of the flag that inspired the Star-Spangled Banner. Late that night, wheels on the ground in Salt Lake City, and on buses from the airport, the group was greeted by hundreds, mostly family and friends, capping off an exhausting and emotional 3-day journey.
So emotional, and every place we went, we found crowds like this, and everybody welcomed us.
Honor Flight hopes first to get as many World War II veterans to the memorials as possible, ultimately to do the same for veterans of Korea, Vietnam, and other conflicts. With Honor Flight, A Generation's Journey, I'm Mark Duke. KSL News Radio.